Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Professor Kishore Mahbubani is joining us now, the distinguished fellow at the Asia Research Institute at NUS, and also the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. And Kishore Mahbubani, welcome to the show today. We're so happy to have you on this National Day weekend.
My pleasure to join you. Happy National Day.
Let's start off. You know, you've been a diplomat, you've been an author, you've been a researcher, obviously dean. You've been in all the different circles pretty much of Singapore public life. Where are we now as a nation?
Well, I would say that we are in a very paradoxical position. And by that, I mean that on the one hand, clearly Singapore is facing one of its biggest challenges, since independence in 1965. Essentially, we've been on an upward trajectory, coming down occasionally during the Asian financial crisis, 2008, 2009, global financial crisis. Clearly, in the 55 years of independence, the tremendous global recession caused by COVID-19 is the biggest challenge ever. And for Singapore, it's especially huge because all our policies were created on the assumption that globalization was a sunrise industry and would remain a sunrise industry for the next 100 years. And now clearly we have seen the biggest retreat from globalization in a long time. So clearly it's a very challenging moment. But at the same time, I say paradoxical because compared to virtually any other country in the world, Singapore has also demonstrated it's one of the most resilient countries in the world and can actually, there's actually no doubt that Singapore will come out of this crisis and Singapore will come out of this crisis stronger. And just to give you a small comparison, in the 1960s when Singapore became independent, one of the shining states in the world in the Middle East was Lebanon. And Lebanon was seen as an example of multiracial harmony, prosperous trading state. And now Lebanon, frankly, is about to become a failed state. And Singapore is about to become one of the strongest states in the world.
We're talking with Kishore Mahbubani, diplomat and scholar. This is Neil Humphreys here, Kishore. And one of the things I'm fascinated to talk to you about, you mentioned this word so often in your public addresses and interviews, stability. Singapore has always attracted investment, particularly Western investment, because it's politically stable. As you've said yourself publicly, nobody invests in Singapore for altruistic reasons. They invest to make money. And to do that, they like to see a stable economy and a stable government. In light of the recent election, you know, one more GRC for the Workers' Party, there is talk that we are slowly moving towards a two-party political state. What is your view on that? And secondly, where do you think that affects Singapore in terms of their stability and how they're seen by international investors?
I think the key word you use is slowly.
I did use that word, yes.
I think in any other country, if you had a parliament of 93 and only 10 are in the opposition, they will say, well, this place has some time to go before it becomes a two-party state. But nonetheless, I think it's important to emphasize that the 2020 elections were very significant because it sent a signal that the population of Singapore actually wants to have an alternative voice in parliament and wants to have an alternative voice in the Singapore political scene. And I see that, frankly, as a very healthy development because going back to my earlier point about deglobalization and all that, we are actually moving into very uncharted waters. So it's very important to have a variety of voices speaking out about the kinds of options that Singapore will have going into a much more challenging environment. So it is, in many ways, a positive development. And I actually think that foreign investment in Singapore will go up rather than go down as a result of what's happened in Singapore.
Talking with Professor Kishore Mahbubani. Kishore, you know, geopolitically speaking, what is the next move that Singapore has to make? As you say, we're headed into uncharted territory. The world is headed that way, but Singapore is, you know, very much has an outsized reaction to what happens around the globe due to our position in trade and those types of topics and banking and oil and everything else. What should the next move on the chessboard be for Singapore to try to stem off these headwinds?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, what has characterized Singapore, and I can say one of my great privileges in my life is that I worked very closely with the first foreign minister of Singapore, Mr. S. Rajaratnam. And what he taught us was always to think the unthinkable and prepare for whatever scenario might come your way. And in the case of Singapore, the geopolitical challenge that is coming is actually sadly very obvious, which is that a major geopolitical contest has broken out between the United States and China. And frankly, the year 2020 will go down as the year where there was a huge spike in the geopolitical contest between U.S. and China. And Singapore is going to face a very tough challenge, maintaining good relations with the United States and maintaining good relations with China, because we are good friends with both. So this is going to be the number one strategic dilemma for Singapore in the coming years. And as you mentioned, I've written a book on the subject to indicate how difficult this geopolitical contest will be.
And very much on that point, one of the things I admire about you is the way you cut through the Western rhetoric of how Western commentators and academics often view, I would say stereotypically, both Singapore and China. And in that context, in that very important context, how do you think the world, whether it's the West, Europe, the US, how do they view Singapore right now in relation to US-China relations?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very complicated picture. Well, one thing is very clear. Unlike the Cold War, you know, in the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union, as you know, many countries rushed to join up with the United States. Europe was a very enthusiastic supporter of the United States, and even third world states like Egypt, Pakistan, Indonesia joined the United States during the Cold War against the Soviet Union. This time around, frankly, very few states are rushing forward to say, hey, we are completely with you in this contest against China, because many of the countries in this region, going all the way up to East Asia, including the major allies of the United States like Japan, South Korea, they do more trade with China than they do with the United States. So it's very difficult for them to accept a binary choice. Are you with the United States or with China? So right now, there's a period of tremendous geopolitical caution. And everybody is basically, number one, not staking their position clearly, waiting to see what's going to happen. And of course, everybody's waiting to see what's going to be the outcome of the November election, to see whether Trump or Biden will win, because clearly the Biden foreign policy, although under Biden, the geopolitical contest with the U.S. and China will continue, but it'll be continued very differently from now.
And on that point, just to follow up briefly on that point, you know, recent stories have suggested, you know, we've had these spy stories, the Singaporean guy who was arrested in the US. Again, I was talking about that point of how Singapore is perceived to be in this China-US situation. You know, there are some who says that Singapore is very pro-China, obviously because of its majority Chinese population. Others hold a different view. Where do you think, as I say, other countries see Singapore? The outsider looking into Singapore, what's our view of Singapore to the world?
Well, I think the most countries in the world admire Singapore for its independence, because it is friendly to the United States, has a close defense relationship with the United States, and of course economic relationship too, because we host more American foreign investment than the rest of Southeast Asia combined. But at the same time, we are also a good friend of China. And I think what makes Singapore unusual is that we are able to speak out openly. So, for example, the speech given by Prime Minister Lee at the Shangri-La Dialogue and the recent article published by Prime Minister Lee in Foreign Affairs are very brave statements, making it very clear that Singapore wants to maintain its good relations with both states and doesn't want to choose or take sides.
Speaking with Kishore Mahbubani, the veteran diplomat, the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. And of course, Lee Kuan Yew was famously, I would say, independent when he came to his discussions with both Beijing and with Washington. He was not afraid to call out either of them, either in favor or against when the moment called for it. And as you say now, Prime Minister Lee is kind of carrying on with a different tone, of course, his own tone, that sort of independence. Your new book, Has China Won? Of course, it was written before TikTok and the U.S. Embassy, U.S. Consulate and the Chinese consulate in Houston events of this past less than a month. Tell us more about that book, your premise in it. And do these recent events have any impact on how you're viewing this contest between the U.S. and China?
Well, I mean, somewhat sadly, I say this. Normally, I should actually be very happy that the prediction that I made in my book that the U.S.-China geopolitical contest will get worse in the coming decades. That's what my book is about. It predicts that very confidently. And I was hoping that COVID-19 will prove that I'm wrong. Frankly, you know, one of the oldest rules of geopolitics is that the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Mm.
And so in World War II, when Churchill decided that Hitler was his number one enemy, he became a good friend of Stalin, who, as you know, was a genocidal ruler. But that doesn't matter, because your enemy of your enemy is your friend. So similarly, since COVID-19 is an enemy of the United States and an enemy of China, the U.S. and China should logically and rationally have pushed the pause button on their geopolitical contest and come together to fight COVID-19, because it's a common enemy and both countries are suffering from it.
Sure.
And if that had happened, of course, the thesis of my book would have been proven wrong. And then I would have suffered, but I would have been happy to suffer. But unfortunately, I have predicted that in this book, it will definitely get worse, because this geopolitical contest is driven by deep structural complex forces. You know, I can just quickly mention three, if you want. The first one, of course, being the fact that whenever the world's number one emerging power, which today is China, is about to overtake the world's number one power, which is the United States, the world's number one power always pushes down the world's number one emerging power. And Graham Allison, the Harvard professor, has written a book documenting this too. Secondly, there has been a fear in the Western world for some time of what I call the yellow peril. It's an emotional dimension here. And thirdly, of course, there was an expectation in the United States that after the United States opened up China's economy, China would open up its political system and become a democracy like the United States of America. But that hasn't happened. So that's created a disappointment in the U.S. That's why there's bipartisan support in the U.S. for this contest against China. So this contest is being driven by deep structural forces, and we must understand the complexity of it, and that's what my book tries to do. If you want to learn how to manage this contest that's emerging between U.S. and China.
And on the subject of yellow peril, yes, there is that Western idea, isn't there, that somehow the Chinese dominance will force them to annex the world and impose their political systems, their economic systems on the rest of the world. But I believe you're of the view that China doesn't really have the will or even the inclination to impose their political way of life on the rest of the world. Would that be fair?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But it's amazing, something which is so obvious, which is that China actually believes that taking care of 1.4 billion Chinese people and keeping China stable is a big enough challenge. So I tell my American friends, the Chinese have no desire to go and fight wars in the Middle East.
Correct.
They are actually very puzzled that the United States is fighting wars in the Middle East, because frankly, the United States, you know, where the average income of the bottom 50% has gone down over a 30-year period, should actually be using its resources to help its own people, especially through COVID-19, instead of wasting money fighting unnecessary wars. So frankly, China doesn't have a desire to step into the shoes of the United States. But of course, I have to balance that by saying that, of course, Chinese influence will definitely grow in East Asia, and the relative balance of power between the United States and China will shift. But this doesn't mean that they cannot have a live and let live policy with each other. At the end of the day, if the primary goal of the United States is to improve the well-being of its people, and if the primary goal of Chinese government is to improve the well-being of their people, U.S. and China can work together. And that's the goal of my book, to try and persuade these two countries, even if only temporarily, to press the pause button on the geopolitical contest and work together to deal with the common global challenges we face today.
But Kishore, as you're well aware, you know, the world we're living in today, the political cycle that we're in the U.S. is an overriding factor, and China is being used, or at least trying to be used, by the Trump administration in that political battle. And on the Chinese side, you know, Xi Jinping has made moves to strengthen his power and make it, you know, more overarching and longer lasting, if I can put it that way.
Yes.
You know, in the real world of geopolitics that we're in, the way you're talking about managing this contest between the two, it doesn't seem like there's much leeway in there to even begin to manage that based on what each side is apparently doing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in the next 3 months, in the build-up to the November presidential elections, both Trump and Biden will beat up on China. Mm. There's absolutely no question about that. But at the same time, you know, the target of my book is not necessarily the mass public, but the more thoughtful thinkers in the world. And so, for example, someone like Martin Wolf, who's considered the most influential economics columnist in the world from the Financial Times, very pro-American, read my book and said it's excellent and gave me a remarkably positive endorsement of my book. Mm. And Farid Zakaria, who's probably one of America's biggest strategic thinkers, named my book as the book of the week in his weekly GPS show on CNN. So the more thoughtful people understand that the message that I'm trying to give for a more reasonable, rational way of handling the U.S.-China contest, they appreciate my book. But of course, the mass public will certainly, in both countries, will become more and more nationalist. And that is, of course, very dangerous.
Yeah, well, we'll hope that certainly the people that need to read that book in the administration, both current and incoming, will read it and heed it. Our thanks to Professor Kishore Mahbubani, Distinguished Fellow at the Asia Research Institute, and also the founding dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, the author of Has China Won? We appreciate your time today, Kishore. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.